bit by little bit, so that by 1960, we decided that maybe it was time for everybody to get together, like we are here. So we sent out a request, and we said, hey, why don't we have a convention? Let's do our thing. And we did. In 1960, we had our first National Lesbian Conference. The Daughters of Belita sponsored it. I've got the convention issue here also, along with a copy of the convention highlights, which I found extremely interesting. It was held May 27th through 30th in San Francisco in 1960 at the Hotel Whitcomb, which no longer exists. We really freaked them out. Reports from that convention indicate that everybody came in really super straight and uptight and wearing their socially acceptable clothes and just kind of got looser and looser as time went on. Things in that included a reception for out-of-town guests. The DOB Research Department presents some comparisons between the lesbian and the male homosexual, drawn from questionnaires circulated throughout the country. Results of the questionnaire were published first in the Ladder for September 1959. That is one of the most interesting studies that I've ever seen or ever had the pleasure of reading. It was a very thorough study that was done, and it was done by a research person who really knew how to handle her statistics and make her comparisons and say what was significant and what was not. There was also a panel discussion on why the lesbian, which included as panelists Dr. Frank A. Beach of the psychology department at UC Berkeley, who co-authored the book called Patterns of Sexual Behavior, which was one of the few non-oppressive books around at that time on homosexuality, which did not put it down as being a degraded, perverted, sick type of thing.
Was that mostly about men?
Pardon?
Was that mostly about men?
Yes, it was. It dealt with an awful lot of different kinds of sexuality. It was just all kinds and sorts of it. And the going idea at that time among psychologists was that homosexuality was kind of like diabetes. It was an incurable illness. It was a disease that could not be cured. Yes, it could be contained, sort of.
He didn't let anyone out.
No, they were just kind of told they were hopeless cases. This was before we thought of. This was before they thought of aversion therapy.
That big advance.
Yes, we've come a long way.
They used to give aversion therapy in the form of shock treatments. I know at the age of 21, I got shock treatments, and I'm sure that's what that was for.
It's very possible. Shock treatments were a very, very early way of dealing with just about everything. When the professions first found out about electroshock, they used it for almost everything, including homosexuality. Try to shock you out of it.
Five times as often, more often as they were used on men, though.
Yes, women really got down with electroshock. Really got downed. They sure are. They sure are. We pick at Langley Porter periodically up in San Francisco because they still use it. Pardon? So we had all kinds of sorts of things at this first convention. We had the Reverend Fordyce Eastburn talk about can the practicing homosexual be accepted by the church. It was at this time that the Council on Religion and Homosexuality was formed. A dialogue was opened with the church right around this time. And the main purpose or reason for that was because our casualty rate was so high. Women were committing suicide. They could not reconcile their heavy religious, moralistic obligations to marry and propagate. They could not reconcile that with the way that they truly felt. And many of them opted out and committed suicide or were lost. They just simply suppressed their, or tried to suppress their desires. The church said, well, yeah, we accept homosexuals, but you've got to be celibate. That's really a great way to do it, huh? So there was a meeting that was held just outside of San Francisco for dialogue between the church and the homosexual. There were representatives from DOB. Billy Talmadge was there. And DOB was rather taken aback because we didn't have any religious people there. We really had to get in touch with some other women to find out where their heads were at on religion. And as a result, the Council on Religion and Homosexuality was formed around this time and began working in dialogue with the church. This is where we laid the beginnings, the foundation for people like William Johnson and... our nice lady from Sacramento, Freda Smith, where the foundations for this were laid, where the door was beginning to open. We were putting a few wedges in here and there. We also discussed civil liberties, the homosexual's responsibility. At this time, we could still lose our citizenship, 1957, 1960. We could lose our citizenship. We could be denied the right to vote. We were not enfranchised at this time. If it was known that you were a homosexual, you could be denied your citizenship. It was also at this time that you could still be denied permission to even visit the United States from outside the country. Yes. They can still request you to. Right.
Or actually thrown out.
Yeah, here in 1975, if you're a gay resident alien, you can and you leave the country. And then try to re-enter it again, you can be refused entry. It is still a law on the books, and it's still being used against us, very heavily against us.
It's also on the books in Canada, that it's legal to be homosexual in Canada, but an immigration may not immigrate if you're homosexual, or if they know that you're homosexual.
And if they're really uptight about you, they can also request your native country to recall you. They'll request your native country to cancel your visa. Like if you're from England or something, they'll call up the British embassy and say, hey, you know, we don't want this dyke running around our society. Will you, you know, cancel her visa? And they will do it. They will do it. It's one of those diplomatic courtesies that country extends to country.
They had, at that point, too, I know a woman who was ordered off, given 24 hours to get off the island of Oahu, you know, because she was a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
Period of time, 56 through 60. It was still a territory, I think, or maybe it was a state. But that's what they would do if they found you. And there was one gay bar over there, so they would find you eventually.
They would. It's also about this time that we began to develop our own culture a little bit more fully than we ever had before. Many lesbians before this time, like Gertrude Stein and Juno Barnes from the 20s, had written books, and Radcliffe Hall had written books dealing with homosexuality, but had not gone very much into our own music, our own laughter, our own art. And one thing that I really enjoyed seeing on this particular list was Lisa Benn. She presented a group of gay folk songs. DOB cut a record at this time also, one of our early gay recordings by Lisa Benn. I haven't been able to find the record. If anyone here, I'm compiling a comprehensive history of DOB, and if anyone here has access to that record, I would love to hear from them. I can be reached at the San Francisco chapter. You can write to my attention. I'd really enjoy getting a copy of that so that I would know a little bit more about it. So that was our first convention. That's pretty much how we shaped it up then and how we carried it through. In 1963 or 64, we tried something new. We thought, well, there's still a lot of lesbians out, and our circulation is going up as far as the latter is concerned. How about if we try the newsstands? So we decided to go slick. We came off of our paper printing and went to glossy paper and got out the cameras and started printing pictures, started printing covers, which we hoped would attract women to buy them. And we started distributing them nationally. And I'd like to read the ad on the back. It shows a picture of a woman looking at a bookstore and is looking at a copy of The Ladder, and the reading down the side of it goes, "She goes for it." She goes to a bookstore near her university to buy The Ladder. Our magazine rates a place in quality bookstores around the country. Single copy price will stay 50 cents even after the subscription rate increase from $4 to $5 a year goes into effect on January 1st. Whether you subscribe or buy your copy each month, why not get a Christmas gift subscription for a friend or for a professional person who would be interested in what our magazine has to say? For order blank, see inside this back cover. The Ladder, a unique gift, a unique magazine. This is from our slick period. The only thing that the publishers of The Ladder learned at that time was that lesbians did not go into any kind of a bookstore under any kind of circumstances to buy any kind of lesbian literature. That was about the result of our findings. But while we were still in this particular time period, we go up to 1967 and we find a change in the way that we're defining ourselves. From educating the variant and advocating a mode of dress and behavior acceptable to society, we move forward. And we are now working on the education of the lesbian, enabling her to understand herself and to make her adjustment to society and all its blah, 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 social, civic, economic implications. Still establishing the library, which is a fascinating library. It's got an awful lot of literature, an awful lot of books in it that are extremely difficult to find anywhere else. However, instead of encouraging the lesbian to wear dresses and using the word lesbian for the first time, they are providing the lesbian a forum for the interchange of ideas within her own group, which I think was a big step forward. In changing the way that we talked of ourselves and the way that we looked at ourselves. Also from this issue, I would like to read a short excerpt called Llangollen on the Left Bank. Vern Niven wrote this, and it is in regards to the death of Alice B. Toklas. The literary address of the 20th century was 27 Rue de Fleurus, mail sent to its former occupants might now well be returned, marked moved, no forwarding address. Early in March 1967, Alice Boyd Toklas, 89, died and was buried next to Gertrude Stein in the famous Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. Miss Stein has lain there since July 27, 1946. The death of her lifelong companion and friend of 43 years marks the end of one of literature's most famous couples, the end of one of literature's great events. Between World War I and World War II, the Left Bank apartment of these women was the nursing home for the literary and artistic greats of this century. Virgil Thompson, Picasso and Matisse, T.S. Eliot, Sherwood Anderson, Ford Madox Ford, Carl Van Vechten, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Ernest Hemingway all were welcomed there. All came away richer, and with one notable exception, Hemingway, very appreciative. About every 100 years, the general public seems to find some extenuating circumstance in a relationship to crown it with the approval and honor ordinarily reserved for more conventional liaisons. The last time was for the ladies of Llangollen, who have rested in their graves in Wales since 1829 and 1831. In a sense, they were fortunate following one another so closely. Alice Toklas's last years, over 20 following the death of Miss Stein, were marked with unhappy incidents. Increasing poverty, and unpleasant lawsuits by members of Gertrude Stein's family over the possessions Alice inherited from Gertrude. Toward the last, Alice joined the Roman Catholic Church, asking her priests if, quote, "this will allow me to see Gertrude when I die," unquote. Whatever one believes, it is pleasant to contemplate some comfortable corner of heaven, two heavily brocaded chairs, some Picasso works on the walls, and Miss Toklas doing needlepoint while Miss Stein entertains the gathered notables. Excuse me, are Felicia or Dana here?
Yeah.
Would they go to the child care center? It's their shift.
Where is that?
I'm not sure where it is. There's this is some of the early development, some of the things that happened between 1957 and 1967, in a period of 10 years. It was at this time that gay women were involved mainly in gay liberation, what little bit of it there was. Stonewall had yet to happen. We were still working mainly very quietly, still working with one another, finding each other, getting in touch with each other, and seeing who we were and where we were, trying to define ourselves. It was shortly after this that the women's movement began, and, well, of course, we already knew the kind of oppression that we were getting from men. We had to deal with it daily. And it was here a split began to develop within the membership of DOB. It's a split that I sometimes feel myself very, very strongly. And that is the commitment that we have to ourselves as women and our rights as women.